Hello, I'm Fee Glover and you're listening to My Perfect City on the BBC World Service. From the makers of My Perfect Country comes this new series, My Perfect City. Same premise, same scrutiny, same belief in the possible and same curious eyes and ears. But this time around, we're going urban. By 2050, cities will be home to 6.4 billion people, the equivalent of the entire global population today. So what happens in them really, really matters. And in My Perfect City, we're going to be building our imaginary urban utopia, using only bits of existing cities that have been proven to work. Transforming slums, solving knife crime, using smart technology. Where in the world are these things being done well? And how can we use them elsewhere? And as always, we need you. You are our citizens. This programme is not just for you. It is all about you. Join in the conversation. You can tweet using the hashtag PerfectCityBBC. Don't worry, I've curbed my inner mayoral desires, and it's not just me deciding what's in our perfect city. It is also Dr. Ellie Cosgrave, Director of University College London's City Leadership Laboratory, and Professor Greg Clark, urbanist and global city advisor. Welcome, team. So, Ellie, I'll start by asking you a huge question. Why is it particularly relevant to be looking at cities now?
Well, firstly, I'm delighted to be talking about cities because cities are my bag. I'm a passionate advocate for the possibilities of the things that we can do within cities to really transform people's lives all across the world. And for me, it's particularly relevant right now because people leading cities are the people who are taking the most progressive action on some of the world's most contentious and problematic issues. It's cities who can take the lead and say, it's important to us, it's important to our citizens, and this is what we're going to do about it.
So, Greg, chunky question for you. Where are cities in the timeline of global history?
Well, the current moment is absolutely unprecedented. There's a way of describing the 100 years we're in by calling them the metropolitan century. From 1980 through to 2080, the urban dimension of the world's population is doubling. And if you like, we're at a moment where we've got a kind of hugely important puzzle. How do we manage the process of rapid urbanization during this century so that it doesn't contribute to climate change any more than it already has, and indeed begins to reverse carbon emissions using these exciting new technologies to do it?
Right, I'm going to give you both a very big VG tick so far. Wherever you're listening to this programme, you are extremely welcome and we would love to hear from you throughout the series. As Greg mentioned, it really is the climate change problem that we have to start with, looking at the environmental challenges of cities. Because if you were building a city from scratch, which we are doing in our imagined world, given our murky climate change horizon, you would have to build it in a sustainable way. You'd have to be bold, you'd have to be firm, and you'd have to consider this place.
I like to say that San Francisco thinks of itself as a city who loves to rehearse the future. We're looking ahead, we're willing to take risks. Rehearsals sometimes are messy, sometimes you make mistakes, but you always learn from them. And that is at the heart of San Francisco's ethos around the environment. I met you in a bar
in San Francisco. That's right. Get your ribbons in your hair, everybody. We're off to San Francisco, the green city of the USA. It is a city of 885,000 people. The average house price for a starter family home is $1.61 million. A loaf of sourdough at the famous Boudin Bakery will cost you $7. And there's a campaign to close Lombard Street to tourists. That is the zigzag one that you see in all the movies because it's being ruined by selfie-snapping visitors. This is also a city that feels its own fragility, having survived earthquakes, fires, and challenging weather. Its trippy past and techie present have combined to make its counterculture really fertile for environmental projects. Our reporter there is Bianca Taylor. Bianca has been out and about talking to locals who are making the city greener and finding out how it works, starting with the everyday business of how people shop and eat.
Buyright Market is one of those places that is uniquely San Francisco. It's a beautiful grocery store right in the heart of the Mission District, just a few blocks away from Dolores Park, which is where I'm sitting right now. And it's a really great example of how people in this city shop and consume sustainably. Sam McGannum is the owner of Byright. His dad purchased the store in the 1960s.
We want the season to be reflected, so you can see the green garlic and the peas and the spring onions and the asparagus, and it's the time of year.
One of the first things that we did was build a kitchen right in the middle of the market. And the kitchen is the heart and soul of the business. It is our recycling center. So when we have blemished fruit, veggies that are starting to wilt, we cook it and we sell it, which in turn helps the economics of our business. It also helps the impact on the land because we're having to buy less. We're not putting this food back out into the waste stream. Over 70% of the product we buy is sourced locally. We're so close to achieving zero waste, you know, which is 90% diversion. We're about 85% diversion right now. All our packaging is either compostable or recyclable. There's still more work to be done, but it's cool.
How have customers responded to your green initiatives?
Our customers are proud. And, you know, this is, I think, one of the things that's really special about San Francisco, Northern California. There's a values alignment here. This is a part of the world where the organic food movement started. So we've got a community that believes that this is an important part of how we should all be living our lives, right? How we should all be conducting business.
Something San Franciscans take very seriously is recycling.
It's so second nature that when I travel, it actually pains me to throw away a plastic bottle or coffee grounds. So every week on Tuesday nights, I bring out three different colored bins to the curb in front of my apartment. There's a green one for compost, a black one for trash, and a blue one for recycling. And these all get picked up by the city's waste management company called Recology. Robert Reed is Recology's public relations manager, and I talked with him at the company's recycling plant.
In recent years, the bins have been 32 gallons for recycling, 32 gallons for composting, 32 gallons for trash. 18 months ago, we began to change that. So we cut the size of the trash bin in half. This giving people larger recycling bins and smaller trash cans has worked extremely well in San Francisco. It's been very well received by the residents. And we've seen an increase in tons being recycled. We've seen an increase in tons being composted, and we've seen a decrease in tons in the trash bin just by changing the size of the bins.
San Francisco made recycling compulsory for people and businesses across the city in 2009, and that includes all food waste.
Food scraps are the most important type of rubbish that exists. That's where the nutrients are, that's where the carbon is, that's where the minerals are. It's crazy to be burying those materials. And by the way, when you put food scraps in a landfill, they produce methane gas and other greenhouse gases which escape to the atmosphere and help heat up our atmosphere and then become absorbed in the oceans, and the oceans are becoming more acidic. So rather than put the good stuff in the landfills and contribute to the problem of climate change, let's take the good stuff, the food scraps, to composting facilities and get those food scraps back onto a farm where they belong in the form of finished compost, and the farms can grow mustard and other cover crops that literally pull carbon out of the atmosphere and nitrogen and get it back into the soil where it belongs. The farm is able to grow more healthy foods, including organic foods, and then they come right back to our tables in the city. So in this way, we are helping feed ourselves. And when you have a strong, robust recycling program, you create more jobs, permanent local jobs. Recycling creates 10 times more jobs than landfilling or incineration.
Public transport is also key to this green city.
If you visit San Francisco, one of the first things you might notice is how many buses there are. You can actually take a bus within two blocks of any residence in San Francisco. And there is a lot of momentum in the city for car-free travel. Sarah Jones is the planning director at San Francisco's Municipal Transportation Agency.
Our green transportation vision starts with our fundamental transportation vision here, which is transit first. And that's actually been around since 1973. It starts out by stating that within San Francisco, travel by public transit, by bicycle, and on foot must be an attractive alternative to travel by private automobile. We got really big and bold in 2017 and acknowledged that by 2030, we are looking to have 80% of our trips occur by sustainable modes. You know, at this point, 26% of our trips are happening by transit, but our transit system is responsible for just 2% of the emissions from our transportation sector and less than 1% of the emissions overall in the city.
Coordinating the sustainable transport system, waste management, and everything else green across the city is Debbie Rafael, director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment.
For me, the thing that encapsulates San Francisco's greenness, if you will, is the way we talk about climate action in four simple words: 0-80-100 routes. 0-80-100 routes. Zero. Zero waste to landfill or incineration. But it's also about reducing consumption. So zero, zero waste. 80. 80% of trips in sustainable modes. That means get out of your car. We make it a little difficult to drive here in San Francisco because we're trying to send a message. There's better ways to get around. We're at about 54% right now, which is wonderful for a city of our size. We've got a ways to go before we get to 80. And 100, 100% renewable energy. That's how San Francisco does less bad in the world. Roots is how we're going to heal the planet. Because Roots is about planting trees and supporting biodiversity. So together, 0-80-100 routes, that's San Francisco's climate action strategy. It's bold, it's audacious, and we're on track to getting there.
Well, let's drill down into San Francisco's audacious plan with Dr. Ellie Cosgrave and Professor Greg Clark. Can we just talk about the very basics of this, Greg? Because I'm sure there'll be many people listening who will think they've started off by talking about composting food waste. Is that really the badge of honour when you're looking at how green a city can possibly be?
Well, I think San Francisco is a pioneer in this space because it's been doing this for much longer than many other cities have been. It has been citizen-led. It's about these lifestyle activities, whether it's food or recycling. But the big challenge for San Francisco is, in a sense, not the areas where citizens can do it for themselves, but the much wider systems, the transport system that was mentioned here, obviously the system of housing, the system of government. So it's an inspiration in terms of civic activism, but has it tackled the big, tough issues that define whether a city is really green or not?
It all sounds lovely. Everybody's holding hands. Ellie, is it the joined-up thinking behind these environmental policies that really makes San Francisco stand out?
I really applaud the vision and the leadership and setting clear direction through which businesses, civil society can get behind and hold government to account. My...
There's a big but.
There is a huge...
Steady yourself against something firm, everybody. Here it comes.
Yeah, well, I guess all of the action that we've heard is premised on the idea that you can have sustainable urban development and infinite economic growth, that both of those things have to match up. Otherwise, we're not really interested in the environmental argument. So we heard that in the example. Zero waste just makes sense because we'll create jobs and we'll be able to do our environmental action better. But what happens when it doesn't make business sense? How is that then driven through in policy?
What about the simple fact, how many people in San Francisco are poor and how many people are well off? To me, the idea that you get to choose your transport is dependent on having a good job and alternatives if you need them. The idea of being able to sort out all of your waste and caring about those kind of issues can also be something that you simply don't have a choice in if you are struggling to make ends meet. Is that a fair assessment?
So in San Francisco, where the real estate is very expensive and where the average wages are very high, there'll be a large number of people with relatively high disposable incomes. But in other parts of the Bay Area, the average incomes will be much lower. And those are the areas where the transport systems don't work quite so well, where the waste systems are not 100% recycling, and where there are other kinds of challenges. So we might
think... So is it green if you're rich and not so green if you're poor? Is it that simple?
Well, we might think of it as more of an enclave of liberalism, where within the city of San Francisco, there's a consensus amongst the broad base of the population that they want to live like this, and the city government is following them and backing them, and that makes sense.
Well, let's poke a little bit more under the shiny exterior. You're listening to My Perfect City on the BBC World Service. In this series, we want to brush up against the people who are finding solutions to global problems in their part of the world and then stand really close to them in the hope that some of their sheer brilliance and vision rubs off on us. If you know such people, do get in touch. Hashtag Perfect City BBC if you're on Twitter. We also have a whole library of programmes at the BBC website. Just tap in My Perfect Country to hear them. This week, we're in San Francisco on the west coast of the United States to see if it could be a green blueprint for other cities to follow. We've heard about some of the city's achievements when it comes to reducing its impact on the environment, and we've applauded loudly. But this is a show that likes to lift the story up, turn it over, so we can check what's underneath and make sure that we aren't falling for a smart, shiny exterior. So back to Bianca Taylor, our reporter in San Francisco.
I'm standing in Bayview Hunters Point, right in the southeast part of the city. It's pretty industrial here, and even though this neighborhood is relatively small, it has some of the highest rates of unemployment and poverty in the entire city. It's also extremely toxic. That's because for a long time, this was the site of a nuclear defense lab and a military shipping dock run by the U.S. Navy. When the Navy left, it did so without cleaning up a lot of heavy metals and radioactive waste, which are still here, polluting the air, ground, and water, and harming the people who live here, the majority of whom are Black.
I could take you to some places in Bayview that you could see forever and a day.
Marie Harrison raised her children and her grandchildren here in Bayview Hunters Point. She used to work in the shipyard as a community organizer, and she actually blames the city's inaction on detoxifying Bayview Hunters Point as the reason for her late-onset lung disease. The sound you hear? That's her oxygen machine that she uses to breathe.
Asbestos, lace, sand, and gravel and dust was escaping the fence. They knew this, identified and known to be radioactive material. One guy even said, I couldn't sleep at night knowing that this stuff was escaping into a community that was already sick. We had the highest rates of breast cancer in the entire city.
Bayview Hunters Point has been in the news a lot lately because as the city and private agencies are trying to develop the land for much-needed affordable housing, the agencies in charge of that cleanup have been accused of falsifying soil samples, essentially lying about how safe the land is for people to live and build on. But nonprofit organizations like Green Action, which Marie has been a part of for 20 years, have long been critical of this cleanup of Bayview Hunters Point. They blame the contractors, the Navy, but also the city itself.
So how does Debbie Raphael at San Francisco's Department of the Environment respond to these charges?
The city, the residents, and the local businesses trusted that the Navy was behaving properly when it discarded radioactive materials and then in its cleanup. And the federal government and the state government are charged with oversight of that cleanup. And what we learned was that the contractors who were doing that cleanup were not to be trusted. So we are looking for trusted partners. We're looking at the University of California and saying, can you help us? Can you come in and tell us what would a good cleanup look like? What would testing look like that could allow people to feel confident that they weren't getting poisoned by historical pollution? It is our obligation as environmental leaders to make sure that the benefits of our climate work, the benefits of our activities around electrification, getting off of fossil fuels, are focused first and foremost in the communities that have been impacted by them.
Well, still with me in the studio are Dr. Ellie Cosgrave and Professor Greg Clark. Ellie, this is San Francisco's story, but every city has a story like this about money, business, power, and the lives of citizens. It's not unique, but do you think it should disqualify some of San Francisco's good that it's doing?
This is not a straightforward task. And when you're a city like San Francisco who's really trying to stretch and take leadership, you're going to make mistakes. And what I really hear in Debbie's response is a real taking seriously the human impact of some of their failures. She will understand that her responsibility now is in listening to individual stories and taking these rights of people very seriously.
So, Greg, we talked a little bit about this before, the notion that a city has a certain level of power, but not total power. It is different. There's a level of government above, which is the national government. How do you feel San Francisco is flexing its muscle?
What a city government can do is to regulate the things that it has control over. It can spend money on the things that it wants to resource, and it can nudge its citizens towards good kinds of behaviour. And in a certain way, San Francisco is doing all of these rather brilliantly. But what this part of the conversation, I think, demonstrates is the limitation of the power. So any city that has a military base within it, or any city that has a port within it, generally knows that the powers of the military and the port trump the powers of the city. And therefore, if the military decides to contaminate a large piece of land and leave it the way it is, the city is, in a sense, at the mercy of that activity. Now, in some parts of the world, the military or the port or any other polluting entity would be regulated differently from the way they are in the USA, and they would not have got away with the behaviour that's occurred here with the contamination that we've seen.
Well, before we do consider if our perfect city would take on San Francisco's green policies, we should look at some other contenders. And here's a little town in rural Japan that's been hitting the headlines. Kamikatsu is home to around 1,500 people. In the past, it burnt all its waste, which was okay when everything was organic. But when plastics arrived, burning them released dangerous toxins. So they needed a new plan. Call it a vision. Kamikatsu aims to be zero waste by 2020. Here's Akiro Sakano, a director of the town's Zero Waste Academy, to tell us how they're doing it.
All the residents bring their own waste to the waste collection center. Then they segregate the waste into 45 different categories we have. So each category shows where it goes, what it will be afterwards, then how much it earns to the community by doing the recycling. We can, for example, sell newspapers for 11 Japanese yen per kilogram. But if you burn everything, then it costs 50 yen per kilogram to burn.
Organic waste is composted at home, and there's also a reuse shop for recycled and upcycled crafts to sell. It's not just good for the environment, it's good for the community too, something cities could learn from.
In the city, you don't have a community at all. So, like, you don't even know your neighbors, and that's a problem. But by doing this, like, new system of, you know, bringing your waste, at the same time, you kind of mingle with your neighbors to bring back the community sense within the city as well.
But what about that goal of being zero waste by 2020?
We still have lots of things coming in from the outside. We can't recycle them because these are not designed to be recycled. So if the companies do not change their product design, then we can't achieve the recycling rate more than 80%. We need to also have the support from the government in terms of supporting businesses to transfer into circular design. Otherwise, of course, they are not encouraged to do so.
So we were intrigued by the success of this small town. Ellie, should we give them a bit of a medal too?
Yeah. I mean, this kind of cultural transformation, this development of community, it takes work and it takes vision and it takes energy. So absolutely to be commended and I think a model for other cities.
Let's talk about some of the other environmental projects. What little examples have caught your eye, Greg?
Vienna's a city that's often described in these respects as a city where it's €1 a day to ride on public transport and therefore very, very high ridership. And it's a city that has really embraced green energy and done that spectacularly well. Curitiba in Brazil is often referred to where people are recycling bottles and cartons and everything else to get tickets to ride on the public transport. And of course, a massive city like Tokyo, one of the biggest city in the world, has got great credentials in this space around recycling and around organic food and everything else as well. So San Francisco's not alone. It was the pioneer, but many others are now leaders too.
So it's going to be very difficult when we're building this perfect city to say, this is the one urban environment that we're going to use, full stop. But I am going to ask you the very simple question. Would we build a perfect city using the blueprint or green print of San Francisco? Greg?
Well, I think we would say that we've taken a lot of inspiration from what San Francisco has done. They have shown to us how citizens can be organized on behalf of the greening of the city. They've shown to us how business and city government can back that. But I think we'd also observe that they've got very challenging targets on transportation in particular. And although they're making progress, they are a long way away from achieving their 80% target of sustainable journeys. And at the same time, their limited ability to influence some of the wider contaminating dimensions that we've discussed before would lead me to say that whilst they've inspired us, they haven't necessarily made the cut. So my answer would be no.
Ellie.
For me personally, what San Francisco misses out is a citizen-centered, rights-based approach to say, this is your human right to live in a pollution-free, safe space. So I would have to say no, because I wouldn't have targets, I would have rights.
Well, what a very interesting start then. We've got to go looking again for our green policy in My Perfect City. We would be delighted to know what you think wherever you're listening to this programme. You can tweet us using the hashtag PerfectCityBBC, or you can visit the BBC website. Now, next week, we're going to be looking at urban smart technology. Every city needs to be built on tech now. It's as important as fresh water and solid rock. You can find out whose ideas we're going to nick at the same time next week. My Perfect City is produced by Eve Streeter. Our reporter this week was Bianca Taylor in San Francisco, and it's a Whistledown production for the BBC World Service. From Ellie Cosgrave, Greg Clark, and me, Fee Glover, goodbye.